Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us today. As unemployment remains relatively low, it's becoming increasingly difficult for many companies to fill open positions. It takes an average of 45 days in the Philly area. We'll have more in just a bit. Also, the Philadelphia home of legendary jazz saxophonist John Coltrane is a National Historic Landmark, and it is deteriorating. Faye Anderson of All That Philly Jazz is leading the charge for preservation. But we begin the show today by catching up to the latest news out of Delaware. It's budget season. Education is a big story for 2020. Wilmington could get its first new public school building in decades. Also, we'll check in regarding how the state is monitoring the coronavirus. The number of AIDS cases being diagnosed is on the decline. And there's some intriguing restoration work being done at Winterthur Museum. Mark Eichmann is deputy managing editor for WHYY. Wise Delaware Desk, and he joins us once again. Great to have you in studio with us.
Hi, Mary. Great to be here.
So budget hearings are underway, and the good news for lawmakers and Governor Carney is the economy is strong and state coffers are flush with cash, Mark.
That is correct, and it's always interesting when the state has a lot to, when the state has a lot of money, whether that makes it more of a fight over that money, or when there's less money, is there more of a fight on where to allocate those resources? So we're in kind of a flush year this year. The state the Economic Financial Advisory Council, which determines how much money the state has to budget, added about $121 million to the amount of revenue expected for the current fiscal year that ends on June 30th. They also increased the revenue forecast for the next year by $82 million. So it's a lot of money to play with for Governor Carney compared to when he first came into office 4 years ago and the state was facing a multi-hundred million dollar budget shortfall. So it's a big change over the last 4 years, and it will be interesting to see how that fight over all that cash plays out.
Well, some big news again out of the budget. Wilmington will be getting its first new public school building in decades, if it's approved, correct?
Yep. The governor's budget plan calls for $50 million to build that new school, and it's going to be on the city's impoverished east side. So it would, in addition to that school on the east side, there would also be renovations for two other schools that have been really needing it.
It is not a high school, though.
Correct. It would be an elementary school. It would replace Bancroft School, which is first through 8th grade, and it would be built on land now owned by the Christina School District.
WHYY-TV just aired a special produced by the Delaware Bureau, which you hosted, called Where is Wilmington High? At the moment, there is no Wilmington High School, which experts say, Mark, is affecting the quality of education for many young people in the city.
Yeah, there's no traditional public high school in the city. There's private schools, there's charter schools, and there's a vocational school for high school students to go to. But there's no general public high school if you just want to go to a regular traditional public high school. If you want to and you live in the city of Wilmington, you have to get on a bus and travel outside of the city limits into the suburbs to go to a school. And there's a lot of reasons for why that has happened, going all the way back to Brown versus Board of Education, desegregation, and the decision to divide the city of Wilmington into four separate school districts, each taking a piece of the pie of Wilmington schools, and really kind of breaking up city neighborhoods, then that kind of cohesion that you have based around
school spirit.
A school, exactly. Sure. You know, like everybody goes out to the football game Friday night. Well, that doesn't happen in the city of Wilmington. If you're going to a football game for your student, you have to go out into the suburbs, some as far as 15 miles away to get to that school.
So very quickly, is there a movement at all to try to get a new Wilmington High in place?
There's a commission now looking at how to improve education in Wilmington. That is one of the things that they're looking at. The mayor is very supportive of that, even though he doesn't have much of a say in education in the city. He's supporting it. There are people on that commission who support it, so we'll see.
Okay. Let's get an update on the coronavirus story as it relates to Delaware. You reported recently, Mark, that two University of Delaware students were being tested for the virus. Any news, any cases at all in the state?
So earlier this month, they tested two students at the University of Delaware. Both of those tests came back negative. There had been another case that they sent out to the CDC to be tested. That was also negative. So at this point, no reported cases of coronavirus have come back positive, three negative tests.
And how is the state monitoring? Is it working with the federal government? Is it
Yep, it's working with the CDC, also working with local hospitals and doctors to keep monitoring anybody who has symptoms, especially those people who have symptoms who traveled to China or anywhere in that region. And the patients that they have tested were put in quarantine in local hospitals before their tests came back negative. So they say they're working well with the government, with the federal government, and with the local hospitals to keep a track.
While we're speaking of serious illnesses, there is some positive news regarding the number of AIDS cases being diagnosed in Delaware on the decline.
Right. Final numbers for 2019 aren't in yet, but in 2018, the state recorded less than 100 new cases of HIV, which is the first time that's happened since the state first started keeping records in 2001. And so that's obviously moving in the right direction. And AIDS Delaware just launched a new testing van that they're going to be taking out to health fairs and other events.
A mobile van
where they can have people come on, do a quick test, and get people results within like 15 minutes. And they hope that getting even more people tested out on the road will help reduce that number even further.
Why the need for a mobile van?
Where AIDS Delaware's office is in downtown Wilmington is up there up on the third floor, and it's sort of difficult for them to really get the word out to get people up to the – it's kind of hinders people from coming in, going up, and getting tested. They figure if they take the van to where people are at, into the neighborhoods, to those health fairs, you know, the whatever event they can get to get people tested, the better.
And quickly, is testing for HIV a complicated procedure?
It's not. It's a quick finger prick, you drop blood, and then within 15 minutes you can know yes or no, and then, you know, make your decisions on what you need to do with that information afterwards. So it's very quick.
Okay. Mark Eichmann, there is some exciting work going on at Winterthur Museum regarding the restoration of some African-American dioramas which were displayed during a World's Fair back in 1940.
Right. It was the American Negro Exposition. It was the first time...
Which is part of the fair?
That was the fair.
Oh, that was the fair.
It was completely focused on African-American accomplishments, art, and it was really their time to celebrate because they'd been kept out of World's Fairs in the past. Sometimes they were even made the exhibits in World's Fair and just treated terribly at these expositions. So this was a time for them to be celebrated. And as a part of that celebration, there were 33 dioramas made, these kind of 4 or 5 foot wide art sculptures of historic events in Black history, you know, from all the way going back to Africa to the construction of the Sphinx, inventors and explorers into modern times, really a chance for them to be celebrated. So at Winterthur now in Delaware, they're restoring several of these dioramas, and they're using students from HBCUs to do the work or to help teach them how to restore this art.
Historically Black colleges and universities, yeah.
Right. In hopes of, from around the country, there's folks there from Texas coming to Delaware, from D.C., all around. And they're trying to use these dioramas to encourage these African-American students to get into the world of art conservation because it's a very white profession. Only 1% or 2% of art conservators are Black. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to use this historic exhibition that celebrated African-American accomplishment to get African-American students excited about conserving this work and conserving other instances of Black art. And
Well, one piece of art is called, it's about the Harlem Hellfighters. Who are the Harlem Hellfighters?
They were a group of soldiers from New York in World War I, who were sent over to France. And back then, they weren't allowed to fight in the army. They were in the army, not allowed to fight. They were told that your job is to dig trenches. So that's what they did until the French army was short on soldiers, and they sort of drafted the Harlem Hellfighters, this regiment from New York, to come to their side. African-American soldiers joined the French army and fought alongside French soldiers. And they got their name from the Germans, the enemy, because they were such fierce fighters. They called them the Harlem Hellfighters because they were so fierce. And the diorama that they were working on at Winterthur while we were there last month depicted these two of these Harlem Hellfighters rescuing an American soldier who they were not allowed to fight next to. And it's based off a painting that depicted a real event of these soldiers rescuing an American soldier who they weren't allowed to fight alongside of. And it's just really, really captures that moment in history in such a beautiful way of the strength of these soldiers fighting for France because they couldn't fight for their own country, and then rescuing an American soldier.
Had no idea this art existed.
Right.
Where do the dioramas go from here?
So from after they get restored at Winterthur, they'll be on display at the Legacy Museum in Tuskegee, in Alabama, and that's where they will be displayed as they gradually get restored.
Okay. We have a couple minutes left. Let's go back to the city of Wilmington, which is planning to open a police academy with a focus on diversity. The department in Wilmington, police department, is majority white, which does not reflect the population, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. So the city's police force is about 60% white. The city's population is about 28% white. So there's concerns about the police force matching what the city looks like. And there was some concerns among members of city council about how the city police department was going about correcting that. And a number on city council wanted to hold off on launching a new police academy class until they got clear direction from the city police chief as to how that was going to be rectified and what steps they were going to take to correct that. Those concerns, I guess, were eventually overruled and the city was allowed to launch a new police academy class. But those concerns still remain about exactly what the city is doing to improve those diversity numbers on the police force.
Tell us about the Explorers program.
So that's a program for a lot of police departments have it where youngsters can come in and experience sort of police work light and get around officers and sort of get a taste for what policing is. And so the city is hoping, the police chief is hoping that launching a program like that for kids in the city, for African-American kids to come in and get a taste of police work and, be around officers will encourage them to, when their time comes and when they're of age, to join in and to apply for a police academy class. And they hope that that will be one of the ways that they can improve diversity among officers.
Do we know when the class is going to be formed?
It's forming now.
Okay.
I'm not sure when graduation will be, but they're in the process of forming the class right now.
Okay. Mark Eichmann, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much for traveling up to Philly to be with us in studio today, and I'm sure we'll be talking soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Mark Eichmann is Deputy Managing Editor for WHYY's Delaware Desk. Coming up, we're going to hear about a new report detailing the difficulty Philadelphia businesses have, many of them, in filling open job positions these days with qualified candidates. Ryo Toshiro is Regional Economic Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. He will be along. Stay with us for that and much more as Radio Times continues on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to WHYY. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. At last check, the unemployment rate remains relatively low. Good news for those who want and need to work, but there is a flip side to the booming job market. Many businesses are having a tough time finding candidates qualified to assume open job positions, and the Philadelphia area has been hit particularly hard. According to a new report from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, the average time it can take for a local firm to fill an open position is 45 days. How is this affecting business and the local economy? And what does this mean for those who are on the job hunt? Ryo Toshiro is Regional Economic Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and co-author of the report titled, What Can Employers Do to Mitigate Hiring Difficulties? Ryo, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, and thank you for having me here.
Is this typical of periods of low unemployment that they become kind of a royal headache for some employers?
So that's a very good question. So we do have some data in the, for the historical period, but I must say that this time is actually really different. So when you look at the official statistics, we know that there are about 6.5 million job openings in the United States at the end of last year. And if you look at the unemployment, for example, there are about 6 million jobs, unemployed people. So, you know, in this time, we have more openings in the number of people who are looking for jobs. And in the previous expansionary period, that was never the case. We always had more number of unemployed people than the number of jobs. So it does look like we do live in a very interesting period of time.
Hmm. Which skills are most in demand in the Philadelphia area? How would you describe them?
So great question. So when we think about all these skills, it's very easy to think about all these technical skills and computer skills and whatnot. But if you look at the data that we used, quite frankly, the skills that were in most high demand were what we call the soft skills, right? So the number one most commonly requested skills were communication skills. For example, some 30% of all job ads that were posted in the United or in the Philly region required some sort of communication skills, followed by things like teamwork, et cetera. So there, I think, of course, these skills are really dependent on particular occupations, but I think they are, soft skills that are required for, common soft skills that are required for a variety of occupations. And, things like communication skills and leadership skills tend to make up, the top 10 list of that.
And when you say soft skills, mm-hmm. describe what that is exactly.
Okay, so, the one that I listed already, communication skills, yeah. So that's one thing. Leadership skills, that's very, very common.
You don't necessarily need a four-year college degree.
So I think when we say skills, that's that's in addition to education and experience requirements. So for the purpose of this paper, we wanted to actually separate the education and experience requirements for the additional skills. So when you think of the typical job ads online, typically a job ad would have education requirement and experience requirement, and in addition at the bottom they say, in addition, we would like you to have such and such, skills. And when we say skills, that's what we mean.
Okay. So, Rio Teixeira, you say, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You found that the occupations which are hardest to fill mm-hmm. and most in demand mm-hmm. are those which are at least at risk for automation.
Correct.
Such as?
So particularly for Philadelphia region, and I think first to a certain degree at the national level as well, but one of the occupations that had the highest average time to fill was teachers. So mm-hmm. both secondary and also middle school teachers. So for example, just to give you some data, in Philadelphia region, it took about 62 days to fill on average a position for a teacher position. And if you think about what teachers do, a lot of what they do cannot be automated, right?
Sure.
So, and if you look at some of the skills that are required of teachers, absolutely they do need good communication skills, absolutely they do need good leadership skills, etc. So I do think that when we think about automation and time to fill, these problems are actually related pretty closely together, because if you look at some of the skills that are required, there are many of them are uniquely human skills. So again, communication skills, leadership skills, etc., that cannot easily be replaced by the current technology that we have.
So for those who are looking for careers and who might be concerned about the increasing use of automation and how it might affect jobs, perhaps look into some of these fields.
Correct.
Which automation is okay. So in doing your research, you organized all occupations into four groups, mm-hmm. correct? One was called routine manual.
Correct.
What is routine manual? An example of?
Great. So these are basically your production workers. So factory workers, drivers, etc.
Okay. Routine cognitive. What is that?
Routine cognitive jobs are jobs are literally routine and cognitive. So these are your sales job, for example.
Okay. Non-routine manual.
They tend to make up building maintenance, protective services, etc.
So you have to think outside the box a little bit.
Correct.
Okay. And non-routine cognitive.
So those are basically everything else. So, these are your, accountants, engineers, economists, lawyers, etc.
All right. And across all these job groups, according to your report, the time it takes to fill occupations in the Philadelphia region was higher than average for all the metro areas you studied?
So we studied about 50 metropolitan areas, and Philadelphia ranked 47 out of 50 when we ranked them by the longest.
Why is this? Did you were able to discern anything in your research as to why?
So I should preface by saying that, you know, comparing across districts was never really a central focus of our paper because we wanted to look at what happens overall at the national level. But when we took the data just for Philadelphia, you know, occupations in Philadelphia, or I should say job ads in Philadelphia, tend to have some of the characteristics that are associated with, you know, longer average time to fill. For example, the same job in Philadelphia, for example, tends to require higher requirement in terms of education and experience. So one example I had was, so if you look at secondary school teachers, for example, and if you compare an average educational requirement for Philadelphia region versus Salt Lake City, which actually was the city that had the shortest average time to fill, Philadelphia had about 15.7 years of experience of education, and Salt Lake City had 15.4. So, you know, in on paper, it doesn't look that much, but if you take the average, it
means
actually,
something.
Yeah, and experience requirement is actually even more stark. So, for example, if you look at average years of experience required in Philadelphia, it's about 1.9 for secondary school teachers. For Salt Lake City, it was about 1.3. So, on average, schools in Philadelphia are asking for more number of years of experience for teachers.
Okay, so let's delve into that a little bit more. Back to education for just a moment. Many employers do like to see a college diploma, which, as you alluded to, can make it harder to fill an open position.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So on average, again, if we take, all metropolitan areas that we study across all occupation, asking for a bachelor's degree and all else equal, it costs about, it adds about 7 more days for an employer to fill that position. So that's about 20% difference. So it is a substantial difference between asking for a bachelor's degree and not asking for one.
And if I'm reading your report correctly, you referenced some information from the Harvard Business School, which argues that this preference to hire college grads is making many middle skill jobs harder to fill.
Correct.
And so I'm taking from that, not quite sure what you mean by middle skills, but immediately looking at it, perhaps there isn't necessarily a need for a college degree in some of these middle schools jobs.
Middle skill jobs, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So especially occupations like, we talked about, non-routine cognitive jobs. Some of them actually may not, necessarily require a college degree. So
managing a building.
Yeah, secretaries, there are, a bunch of other occupations that we can look at. So I think the overall message that we wanted to send through this paper was really when, firms, send out these, online job ads, they should really be thinking about if that occupation actually needs a bachelor's degree. Can someone with a high school degree or even an associate's degree do, the job just as well? Or they should also be thinking about, the years of experience. Does that, job actually require 5 years of experience? Or, can somebody with either, 2 years or 3 years of experience, fill that role?
So obviously wanting experience from a prospective employee is understandable, but you're saying that the importance of experience, if I'm hearing this correctly, is sometimes overestimated at the expense of getting the job filled.
Right.
And so, done correctly.
Right. So I think it really depends on the, case by case scenario. I think there are some cases where, a job absolutely does require both a bachelor's degree and, 5-7 years of experience. But I think the point of this paper was to try to really think about, do these jobs actually, does that person really need 5 years of experience from the day one? Can we hire somebody with perhaps, fewer years of experience and just hire him or her internally so that the person can do the job just as well as the person who came in already with 5 years of experience?
I know we're getting off track here a little bit with this question, but the whole process of applying for a job and hiring people has changed so much over the past few decades. Mm-hmm. So much is done online now. So many applications are just, I think they're nuked even before they get to the the desk of the person who's doing the hiring. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that a lot can be taken from having people actually come in and not, you know, sorting through some of these applications and not necessarily automatically having maybe bots sort through, you know, the experience and the education, and opening it up to perhaps interviewing a wider range of people.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess with the data set that we had, we couldn't really measure that directly. But the way that we, you know, the way that we could do that was by actually looking at the number of additional skills required in the job ad. So, you know, if you look at our research, you know, we found out that, you know, up to a certain point, the more, the higher the number of additional, you know, requirement is, actually, it does actually make your job more easier as a hiring manager. So it is associated with shorter average time to fill. And we think it's because of exactly what you said. I think, you know, if you think about your own sort of most successful hiring experience, I think the most successful hiring experiences were when you actually knew exactly what you wanted for job applicants. So, you know, in that sense, I think, you know, having more number of higher number of, you know, additional job requirements tends to reflect how ready you are as a hiring manager.
Do prospective employers perhaps need to embrace the concept of nurturing new hires as opposed to, again, looking for more, you know, years of experience?
Absolutely. I think that was one of the points from this paper. I think as, you know, the labor market is, you know, continues to even be tighter, and as we run out of, you know, workers to, you know, fill these openings, we do have to start thinking about what can we do with the existing workforce. Can we actually hire somebody with perhaps, you know, not the, you know, most advanced degree or not even the, you know, most number of, you know, past experience, but can we actually hire less experienced people and train them internally and have them, you know, do these jobs. And I think that becomes, you know, very important in this, particularly in this very tight labor market.
And perhaps a little scary for many employers to take that step.
Yes, yes.
Well, how does all this affect the economy? The fact that it can take so much longer for Philly area businesses than in other parts of the country to actually get qualified people in and on the job.
Right. So, you know, when we think about, you know, low unemployment, I know, you know, mostly it's actually very good news for people who are looking for a job. Many people who, you know, want a job, you know, already have a job. But I think the flip side is that, you know, if firms want to, you know, expand even further and if we want to grow as an economy, we need people to do that. And, you know, if we can't find people to do that, then basically companies are just sitting on projects that are that can't go because they just simply don't have the people to do it.
We are speaking with Ryo Toshiro, Regional Economic Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, co-author of a new report addressing this very issue that many employers are unable to hire qualified or having difficulty hiring qualified applicants, even as unemployment remains low. Ryo, you also examined in the report the idea that offering higher wages reduces hiring difficulties. It would seem obvious, you know, that offer more money, you'll get more qualified applicants.
Sure.
But is this necessarily so?
So so that was something that we wanted to explore. And we did find that there was actually, you know, that relationship was true for routine and manual jobs. So we talked about, you know, previously we talked about different types of jobs. So your factory workers, your service, you know, workers, and et cetera. So for those type of occupations, I think it does. The data tells us that hiring you know, offering higher wages tend to actually shorten the average time to fill. However, with that said, for all other type of jobs, so namely non-routine cognitive jobs, so these are basically your, you know, accountants, lawyers, engineers, economists, etc. For those types of jobs, you know, higher wages are actually associated with even longer time to fill. And I think there are, you know, few ways in which we can think about this. One obvious one is that for the routine and manual jobs, perhaps you know, the actual job and the tasks that you're asked to do are very similar, you know, across different employers. So for example, if you are a truck driver for, you know, company A, you know, what you're going to be doing is very similar to a truck driver in company B. So obviously, you know, the wages actually will matter greatly if you're trying to decide between company A and company B.
Sure.
you know, on the other hand, you know, if you're an economist, for example, you know, being an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia may be very different from the economist at private sector. So I think, you know, I think there is, you know, monetary incentive here, but I think it's not the whole story. And we think that for routine manual jobs, I think the monetary incentive is actually, you know, higher for those types of jobs, not so much for non-routine cognitive jobs.
One challenge many Philadelphia businesses are facing is what you call a skills mismatch. Mm-hmm. Define that.
So skills mismatch is when you know, employers want specific you know, job applicants who have, you know, very specific skill sets, and it happens when the supply of labor, namely the applicants, can't give them that. So one of the reasons why you know, things like, you know, teachers you know, take you know, a lot longer to hire is because, you know, schools may want a certain type of people to become teachers.
And there just isn't that pool of applicants in this area.
That is correct. Yeah. So if you look at the demand and supply, it does look like the demand is basically much, much higher than the supply with the ongoing requirement and ongoing wage rate.
So to recap, some of the top listed skill requirements in the Philadelphia metropolitan area are, in other words, what are businesses looking for in terms of skills? If you're out looking for a job, the top skills that they're looking for.
So number one, for sure, communication skills across all occupation types, across all industries. So, you know, about 30% of all you know, job ads require some sort of communication skills. Leadership skills is something that you know, people look for. Teamwork is increasingly becoming difficult. Teamwork accounted for about 15% of all skills listed. So of course, they are you know, technical and hard skills that are listed for very, very specific types of occupations. But when you look at the overall trend for all types of occupations and all types of industries, I think these you know, soft skills such as communication skills and leadership skills and teamwork skills tend to be a lot more important.
Some of the jobs most in demand in the Philadelphia metropolitan area include?
Middle school teachers and high school teachers both took about 62 days to fill. And also healthcare providers, so nurses, recreational therapists, and mental health counselors also took about you know, 60 days to fill.
Do you see the situation turning around anytime soon, Rio? For employers?
I would think that as
and
long
I'm
as...
And I'm asking for a look into the crystal ball here,
right,
for
so
10 seconds.
as long as the, you know, the, you know, labor market continues to be as tight as it is, I think the problem is actually going to be worse.
Okay, well, stay tuned. Rio Teixeira, thank you so much
thank
for joining us.
Thank you so much
us.
For having me here.
He is Regional Economic Advisor for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. Up next, we talk about the deteriorating state of the John Coltrane House in Starbury Mansion. Faye Anderson of the Public History Project, All That Philly Jazz, is with us to talk some more about this. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There is something indefinable yet special about the worn, stately row home at 1511 North 33rd Street in Philadelphia's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood. A sense, perhaps, of the magic of a bygone era, Philly's golden age of jazz. The blue historic marker posted outside the house tells passersby that this was once the home of John Coltrane, the celebrated jazz saxophonist and composer, a place where he experienced important formative moments as a young adult developing his craft. Unfortunately, the Coltrane House is falling into disrepair. Without funding and restoration, the significant piece of Philadelphia cultural history will continue to fade away. And before we go any further, I should note we've been listening to Coltrane's Blue Train. Faye Anderson is director of All That Philly Jazz, a public history project which is documenting Philly's golden age of jazz. She's leading a campaign to restore the Coltrane home. And she's back with us now for Radio Times to talk about the story. Nice to have you with us, Faye.
Thanks for having me.
First, for those who are not familiar with the jazz world and John Coltrane, he was a true influencer of the genre. Tell us a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely. John Coltrane really stands alone. Every musician, no matter the genre, whether it's rap, So they will reference John Coltrane. In fact, a song that I have listened to for decades, it wasn't until a week ago that I realized that he gave John Coltrane a shout out. It was James Brown's Superbad. He tells his saxophonist, "Throw me some train, brother."
What was John Coltrane to Philadelphia, and what was Philadelphia to John Coltrane?
Well, John Coltrane was born in North Carolina. He came here as a young adult, and it was really, he became part of an ecosystem that nurtured young jazz musicians. It's not a stretch to say there was jazz everywhere. So he had an opportunity to learn here. And you cannot separate Philadelphia's golden age of jazz from John Coltrane. When you mention the house in Strawberry Mansion, Row House, when he first moved here, he joined his mother, who was already here, and they lived in an apartment on 12th Street in Yorktown. And he bought the house in Strawberry Mansion, Row House, in 1952. He bought it with the GI Bill. He had served in the Navy. So he moved there with his mother and his beloved cousin Mary.
Let's talk about the house itself. In pictures, despite the wear and tear, it seems to have really great bones.
Let's hope. We don't know that, to put it in context, Philadelphia has thousands of properties and historic resources listed on the local Register of Historic Places, but there are only 67 that are designated National Historic Landmarks, and that's a designation made by the U.S. Secretary of the Interior and is given to places of national significance. And of the 67 in Philadelphia, the 67 includes the Academy of Music, the very place where John Coltrane heard Charlie Parker for the first time. And he later said it changed his life. So you have this man who heard Charlie Parker at this National Historic Landmark, and now his very home is a National Historic Landmark.
This house was witness to Coltrane's formative years.
Formative years.
And he went through a lot of formation as an adult.
His formative years, and as he wrote in the liner notes to A Love Supreme, the album of Love Supreme, he experienced a spiritual awakening there.
How so, Faye?
It is where you would have to ask him what the exact spiritual awakening was. But it was in that house, in the second floor bedroom, back bedroom, where he withdrew. He kicked his heroin addiction cold turkey. So but for what happened in that house, we would not be talking about John Coltrane. He might have gone the way of his idol, Charlie Parker, who died from an overdose. So you cannot separate what happened in the house, the spiritual awakening, kicking his drug habit, cold turkey. And it's also where he composed the album Giant Steps.
Tell us about the deterioration of the home.
I wish I can tell you more. That as a National Historic Landmark, the National Park Service has responsibility to monitor the condition of the house. So as long ago as 2003, the National Park Service noted that there were structural concerns. But again, all it can do is make a recommendation. It does not have the resources or the authority to make the repairs. So this was 2003. Nothing has been done. 17 years later, the house was built in 1909, so it's over 100 years old. So time is not on its side. Mm-hmm. And without access to the property, we don't know the structural integrity.
It is vacant.
It is vacant. It is vacant, and it has been vacant for some time.
It has landed on something called Preservation Pennsylvania's 2020 roster of at-risk sites. What does it mean to a property, Faye, when something lands on this roster?
Well, it means, first of all, it's endangered. There is concern. The list is compiled by Preservation Pennsylvania, which is a nonprofit whose mission is to protect, advocate on behalf of historic and architecturally significant properties. So the listing is an annual listing, and it's intended to bring attention to the condition of historic resources that are in danger. So we nominated, we meaning the Preservation Alliance for Greater Philadelphia, Jazz Bridge, and Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, we submitted the Coltrane House for listing on 2020 Pennsylvania at Risk, and the nomination was successful. And what is hoped with the nomination is why I'm here, is to bring attention to the condition of the Coltrane House, and hopefully action will be taken. When you said that I'm leading a campaign to restore the Coltrane House, that's getting a couple of steps ahead, because okay. without access to the house, there is no campaign. In fact, I've heard from any number of people who have asked about donations. I said, no, cannot solicit donations because it would be a scam. We do not have access to the house. And so the house was sold. Again, Cousin Mary moved there with her cousin John Coltrane in 1952. He lived there from 1952 to 1958, and on his frequent trips back to Philadelphia, he stayed there. But in 2004, Cousin Mary sold the house to Norman Gadsden, who was a jazz lover who had wonderful plans for the John Coltrane House, but he died 3 years later. And so we don't even know who the owner is, because the owner of record is a man who died in 2007. Hmm. And so we know the family that has access to the property, but unfortunately, for whatever reason, they're not cooperating, and they have not been cooperating for some time.
So, Faye Anderson, if somebody were listening to this program and were interested in helping to whatever it takes to gain access to get a funding stream going, do they check in with Preservation Pennsylvania first? I mean, what is the first step does it take toward trying to move this process forward?
Oh, the first step is to call Mayor Jim Kenney. May I give the number?
Oh, why not?
Call Mayor Jim Kenney at 215-686-2181. Because to the untrained eye, you can see the violations. You can see the holes in the exterior. That the Department of Licenses and Inspections, LNI, has the authority to go in. So Mayor Kenney today, yesterday as even, he can tell LNI to go in and inspect the property. One of his spokespersons said, well, the city has limited resources. They're already on the payroll. It's not going to cost anything extra for a city employee to go and do their job. But when you think about the city, how much money the city has spent maintaining the Frank Rizzo statue, that a statue that the mayor says he doesn't want, residents said they don't want, but still city employees are maintaining that monument to hate, that if someone has recently threw some oodles of noodles on the statue, city employees were Johnny on the spot. So what we want is for Mayor Kenney to tell LNI to inspect the property.
You are angry.
Well, yes, I am, because it's ridiculous that we mentioned Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo actually has a reputation among jazz musicians for harassing jazz musicians. So the idea that Frank Rizzo would be protected, but John Coltrane House, a house that people from around the world come to visit, they look at that house and they think, they see the condition of it, that no one cares. The truth is, people do care. The Preservation Alliance gets more calls about the John Coltrane House than any other historic property.
Faye Anderson, you say that preserving Coltrane's home would send a message to underserved communities?
Well, absolutely. What does it say if again, it's a national historic landmark. That means it has national significance, that if we cannot protect the John Coltrane House, the message it sends is one that Philadelphia is not about diversity. Philadelphia is about Ben Franklin. Philadelphia is about the founding fathers. So come to Philadelphia and see this narrow narrative of what Philadelphia is. I talk a lot about John Coltrane being a metaphor for diversity inclusion, because John Coltrane's Philadelphia was about inclusion.
Tell us more about that.
Well, the jazz clubs, you had one, the Checker Cafe. In fact, PHA wanted to demolish that building. I stopped there. But you had female impersonators at the Checker Cafe, that one of the reasons jazz clubs were harassed is because of the jazz culture. It was the first time that blacks and whites were socializing on an equal basis.
Together
in jazz clubs, like the Downbeat, which the Philadelphia police harassed to the point where it put them out of business, that your listeners may be looking forward to tomorrow when the documentary on Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, airs on PBS, that a night when the Miles Davis Quintet was playing at one of those clubs, the Blue Note, they call them black and tan clubs, the Blue Note, which was at 15th and Ridge, the very night that the Miles Davis Quintet was performing there, and John Coltrane was a member of the Miles Davis Quintet, the police raided the Blue Note. And then there was a headline a few days later in the Philadelphia Inquirer when the owner said, no, we're not going away of the Downbeat. You will not put us out of business. So to talk about John Coltrane, to talk about Philadelphia's golden age of jazz, which was roughly the 1930s to the 1960s, okay, you're really talking about a culture of inclusion and diversity.
There is, will you lead a walking tour of Green Book sites?
Oh, yeah.
The Green Book, of course, helped African Americans navigate racially segregated America. And Faye, I guess a number of these sites in Philly in particular are in North Philly. What would the John Coltrane House add to the tour? Tell us a little bit about the tour and how you envision perhaps having the Coltrane House on there.
That the largest cluster of remaining Green Book sites are in South Philly, that Center City and South Street area. That the John Coltrane House in North Philly, that would be the second largest cluster. So what I would envision for the John Coltrane House, that at some point we are going to get past this current impasse with the condition of the house, because it's indefensible, it's not sustainable, that the mayor, I was involved with the effort to save the Robert Purvis House, which was home of an abolitionist, which, again, an owner not cooperating, and Elle and I finally did go in, but half of the structure had to be demolished. We don't want to wake up one day and half of the Coltrane House demolished. So there is a precedent for Elle and I going in. And so the John Coltrane House could anchor cultural heritage tourism in North Philadelphia. And there are a number of Green Book sites, not in business, but the buildings themselves still in existence, many of which are located on Ridge Avenue in Shaw's Wood.
All right. So it begins with the administration getting into the house, doing an inspection, and then hopefully being on the at-risk site. Perhaps we can get a funding stream going in order to do renovations, restorations, to live up to that blue historic marker that's standing outside the property.
Well, not to live up to, the marker, but live up to the man.
That was a poor choice of words.
to live up to the man.
Yeah.
The man who left us a love supreme, a man who was all about love, to show him the love that he showed us.
All right, we're going to go out on John Coltrane's Giant Steps. Faye Anderson, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Keep us posted.
Will do.
All right, Faye Anderson is director of the Public History Project all that jazz. Don't forget to join us on social media. You'll find everything at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in to Radio Times.